Welcome to our podcast, Transparently Speaking. I am Diana, and I have a son who transitioned at a young age to become his true self.
And I am Joy. I have also supported my daughter to transition at an early age. We are here to share our experience and our learning along this journey.
We want to provide support and guidance parent to parent. And if you find yourself on a similar journey, we want you to know that you are not alone.
So let's dive in, Transparently Speaking.
Diana, you were just giving me an update, and I think it's a fantastic topic for today's session, your update on an appointment you just had with Dinah last week.
Yes. So I took Dinah to the gender clinic last week, and just to be very clear to our audience, there is no medical treatment or surgical treatment that is occurring. Very clear. No treatment whatsoever.
Because Dinah is how old?
Dinah's 7 and a half, 7. So the reason that we made the appointment, to be quite honest, I don't know what Dinah wants and what Dinah doesn't want, as far as even whether he wants medical treatment or not is unknown at this point. However, because bodies that are under an estrogen dominant reproductive system, they can begin puberty anywhere as early as 8 or 9 years old, and as late as 11 or 12. And so we wanted to make sure to establish care before we were there asking for medical treatment, if that is something he would even want. So we were just trying to establish care, and it's often, you know, recommended and to touch base. And so it can be documented that yes, his name is Dinah, and yes, he identifies as a boy, and they got the history of when that began and all those things.
Was it the very first appointment in the gender health
Yes.
clinic for Dinah? Oh, okay. So it was the very first appointment for Dinah. Okay.
Yeah. And it was interesting because it was like trying to explain it to him. I was like, well, you know, what they do is they support people who are transgender, and some people who are transgender, you know, desire, like see themselves looking a certain way. So some people see themselves with breasts. And other people don't. And some people say the facial hair. And he's like, no facial hair, none. I'm like, okay. Well, I said, so, and he's like, no breasts, none. I'm like, okay. We've got a problem. So, you know, I just kind of casually explain, well, as you get older, either breasts develop and not as much facial hair. I say not as much because genetically it's going to be some, but sorry. And on the other hand, you can more coarse facial hair, deeper voice. And so he's like, well, I don't want either of those. And it's like, well, at some point you pick up one. If you choose breasts and you don't want breasts, then you'll have to live with breasts for a period of time until you're at a point in which they can be removed, but you will have to live with them, and then they can be removed if that's what you desire at that time. Or you can not have breasts and have facial hair, and you can shave it every day, or there are even procedures to try to have it not grow anymore, but it takes time. And so he's like, definitely no facial hair. Yeah. So like I said, I don't even know if he wants anything. And I also think it's hard for him to understand. And it's one thing we were talking about what education Dinah has had. And I explained that because of my awareness, I didn't raise him to be like, this is a boy thing, this is a girl thing, regarding his anatomy, regarding appearances, regarding any of it. He definitely has learned of appearances, but I've never said anything about genitals and gender. So he doesn't connect his body to being gendered at this point. And she's like, I totally get it. I did the same thing with my kids, which makes it more challenging to know, are they upset with their body? Are they just not aware? You know, like, what is it? And he's still young too. And add an extra layer to that of like neurodiversity. So we also talked about how that may create or not create an awareness of those differences.
Okay, interesting. So I'm really curious, and maybe for our listeners, since we've gone through this, but it's been several years, what is the intention or the requirement that there is this first therapist meeting during that very first assessment and meeting with the gender health clinic?
So it's interesting because like 10 years ago, depending, every institution had its own thing. I think they still do. but there was no insurance requirement. So every institution had their own protocol. I remember one institution we visited was like, you had to have 3 therapy appointments and the therapist would write a letter. So what I was told, and I think, I don't know that the clinic we go to when we first joined, I don't know that there was a number of appointments per se, but you had to have somebody some therapist be able to write a letter to support the use of a medical treatment. But what was brought to our attention this time is like, it is more important now than ever that you have a therapist. There's not a certain frequency. There's not, you know, a certain number of visits. It's just an established care that they know you well enough, Dinah in this case, to be able to write a letter of support. And there have to be some regularity of visits. It's not like you can go once and never go again. But that regularity, and what was explained to us is that there are these hoops now, and now it's needed for insurance. Like I said, it wasn't needed that way before, but now I think it's needed. They didn't say for what. They said for more things to validate care. And she's like, there are more hoops for you to jump through now than you did before. And there are more coming down the line. And I'm so sorry, because there's no other issue in health that you have to jump through so many hoops for a certain like health issue. I'm not talking about access to care, totally different, but to get the health care for a health issue, there is no other place in medicine that you have to jump through these number of hoops to get your care. And I think that was so upsetting to hear. I mean, I know it's not surprising. We've known for a while we had to do these gymnastics and these dances, but it was like, I think the words, and they're more coming down the line. It's like, what else do we have to do?
Yeah. It sounds exhausting.
It is. And at the same time, it was such a relief to be there. Like, it's so validating to be in an office where you can show up and you don't have to explain anything to anybody. Yes, his name is Dinah and he identifies as a boy. And there's none of the awkwardness. Like, you just feel accepted and supported. And I hope it's everywhere, but these providers in particular, like, I asked the endocrinologist about, you know, what can we do to support you? Are you okay? I've heard rumors that you got death threats. And she didn't respond. So I don't know. Like, she didn't affirm it or deny it. She just said, just know that we will do everything we can to continue to give you all the care that you need. And it was just so nice to hear in a world where all we can hear about is how abusive we are and how distorted we are and how, you know, just fill in the blank.
And how these choices we're making for our children are bad for our children and generate these risks and everything else. Yeah.
We're destroying them.
Yeah.
Yeah. All those things. Like, just to have that space where you're just accepted and loved. And unfortunately, I don't feel that way in all healthcare spaces. I feel like there's a desire for it, but they just don't know how. And sometimes I feel like there's a lack of understanding, but the need to pretend to understand. Which maybe I should be thankful for, but not completely. I'm just honest. I'm trying. But, you know, but that whole like therapy, you know, they gave me the list. There's only one person in our area. And then I come to find out, and the list is old because I knew there was somebody on there that no longer was accepting patients. And, you know, I think the person that was in my area had once been a good provider, but another authority outside of the clinic was telling me that had some issues lately and may not be the best time to go see that person. So it was like, okay, well, who am I left with? I have to find somebody that understands gender and understands neurodiversity. And yes, therapists are supposed to be trained on it all, but they're not, or they're not as experienced in it all. So to get somebody that understands both and that can experience it, like, it can help us in a balanced way. And what I mean, it's not on the side of, well, have you tried harder to, you know, make him a girl? And not on the other side either of challenging everything we do as getting in his way. Do you know what I mean? Like, just working with us. And I, I'm at a loss. I don't know. I mean, I say I don't know what to do, which keeps me not making phone calls, but maybe I'm more relaxed because of Dinah's age. Maybe I'm more relaxed because it's not clear that he wants anything. Although I think puberty blockers would serve him as far as time, when that time comes. I mean, we'll see what he's like then. But it's like, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to get him the care he needs to be able to get what he needs. Like, there are a lot of hoops to jump through.
And like, what's interesting is this dissonance between, obviously, we're so grateful that the care exists and we're able to access it and that we've got these amazing providers. And then there's the accessibility, right? As part of these hoops that we're talking about, because I remember that even too, as Samantha, you know, prior to us starting the hormone therapy for her, that we also needed to have, you know, this record of engagement with a therapist because we hadn't really engaged in any regular way. And we had similar problems. There was a list, you know, that was shared, and then half of the list wasn't accepting new patients. And then the other half of the list, like, they didn't really have any expertise or experience in gender care. And it was really challenging.
Mm-hmm. And then so many therapists, like, you're limited, like everyone, regardless of why you're looking for therapy, it's limited. There's waits, it's everywhere. And on top of it, many of them have schedules in which I have to take, like for Clark, I have to take him out of school for every single appointment. And that's just so disruptive, especially being in high school. I mean, luckily he doesn't care, but if it were my other kids that do care about their school, I wouldn't be able to do it. And for Dinah, it's not that he cares about his school, but the issue for him is, like, as a kid that like likes routine, that disruption, he's fairly flexible with it, but doing it too often is, we did have a therapist for a while and she was great. And I didn't have to explain gender to her, but she also was not like her expertise to back it up either. And I stopped seeing her because Dinah wouldn't want to go because it meant going to school late. We would do first thing in the morning. So he'd just go to school late. He didn't want to miss that, like the morning routine where they spell out what the day is going to be like. And he wasn't super engaged. And she also didn't understand gender. So I'm like, not that she didn't understand it, but she couldn't support us on that. So it was like, why keep going forward in this? Let's just stop and see if we can find somebody else, which we're at zero.
Yeah. So what I'm really hearing is affirmation of, in general, our endocrinology support in this beautiful space that we have, right? Care for in our children's hospital here. And this really clear message from them about, yes, this is challenging. We're all having to fight for it. And here's the process. FYI, there might be more hoops to come.
Yes. And I think that one thing that I would like to do, besides take care of my family, is to write a letter of support to the hospital for the clinic. Because even though our doctor wouldn't talk about it, I mean, you and I have talked about that, we've heard whispers in the wind of threats and losing funding for that. And I just think it's going to be important for us to say what it has meant for us to have them there. I mean, we used to have to travel out of state for care, and I really don't want to go back to that. So just, I think Arthur and I are going to draft a letter. But I also think wherever you are, if you have a gender clinic in your area, you don't have to be a patient there to say, hey, I love the fact that my children's hospital supports all patients. So I know that whatever we bring will be supported too.
It's a beautiful message.
But for now, no beards.
So funny. No beards and no breasts.
Well, at one point he was like, what are breasts? And I'm like, I'm like grabbing myself to be like, these things. And he's like, I don't know. And so for our listeners, I'm extremely small chested. And so I really consider like showing a picture of Dolly Parton where there's actual cleavage to be like, the things that make this line here. Those are breasts. They come in all sizes. I actually, it was funny because the therapist's like, well, do you have books? And I'm like, do I have books? I have like every gender inclusive anatomy book there is. Like, I got books. So that is one thing I've meant. And I talked to him. I'm like, hey, like after the visit, I'm like, hey, you want to look at some of my books? And he was like, no, nope. I'm busting him out anyway. No, I mean, at that point, I'm not going to push to that point. But what I might do is take it when I'm in a similar area and just look at it myself. And if he gets curious and looks over and I just happen to be on the chess page.
Yeah, clandestine ways to educate our children, right? Funny. So Diana, this sounds, you know, honestly just sort of exhausting. And I'm wondering if it might support our listeners to provide a little more context, at least from our experience, about this initial appointment with providers in terms of establishing care. Like, what does it really look like? What are they looking for? What are they asking about? Both the endocrinologist, I think I'm hearing you met both with an endocrinologist and a psychologist.
Yes. And every gender clinic is different. Like ours is run as endocrinologists. Some places are adolescent medicine and pediatrics and not necessarily pediatric endocrinology, but where we are is pediatric endocrinology. So yes, you meet a therapist first. They get the history of like, what are the signs? When did they first say that, you know, how they identified? How did that play out? So they get the full history to document and record. They also explain the need for therapy and gave the list of information and question where you might need support and make sure they provided options, even if they're not one of them, you know, for you. And then the endocrinologist comes in, kind of goes through some of that history again to make sure they understand. Both of them checked on the understanding of Dinah and what does Dinah understand? What does Dinah want? Also understanding that at his age, he may not have the awareness or understanding of what he wants. So they didn't talk to him about that per se. I forget. They did a beautiful way of kind of generally wording, we just help support people. And I don't want to, try to misquote them, especially right now in our political environment. But it was just a beautiful, really open way of saying that they'd support him and do a very quick exam to document.
A physical exam.
Physical exam, medical exam. And then that was basically it. And set a course, the endocrinologist said, make sure that you have some sort of mental health provider. And then we'll see you back in about a year, just again to check in. And this is the thing, to have that documentation to check in. But I will say that checking in for me feels like a double-edged sword. On one hand, I completely trust the clinic and I feel good about having the documentation to support if he decides, he may not, but if he decides for that, that we have this additional documentation of his identity and the consistency of it. And not that I think identity has to be consistent, but unfortunately, in this political environment, it helps. So there's that. But then I was recently reading about when Governor Abbott in Texas made the mandate to consider gender-affirming care child abuse. I didn't realize it until I was reading this, that it meant all mandatory reporters, which is healthcare and teachers, had to report anything that is deemed as child abuse as defined by the law, and because his mandate until the court shut it down defined gender affirming care by parents as abuse, it meant that healthcare providers had to turn in their patients or lose their license because they're mandatory reporters, and that's how he defined it. So even though it might sound like, well, that's really far-fetched, and it is with our current governor, to be honest with you, but it still plays in the back of my head how things can turn. You know, what will the next election bring? What if they did that? Then me just trying to establish care, even though he's not getting any medical intervention, he's getting medical care, but not medical intervention, could turn us in with the wrong governor.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
So it's like, which way on the teeter-totter do you lean?
Meaning, do we seek this or do we continue, or do we wait until it's absolutely
take your chances and not have the documentation? Yep, exactly. Obviously, you know what I chose, but
I think there's so much of this unknown right now, and that's influencing, as we talked about in our last podcast, or last couple of podcasts, a challenge that we're facing in terms of decisions. Yeah, Diana, I think what this unknown that I hear you reference is the experience you and I are having too, and navigating. What does that mean, given we've made a choice to move? What risks do we take on if we choose to stay in state? And how do we navigate that decision to potentially consider moving out of state?
Right. It's this constant risk benefit, knowing that like the environment's changing everywhere. I mean, we saw this past week, just real positive, that Minnesota governor, you know, put in that executive order to protect, to be a sanctuary state. And so like, who knows who else will become a sanctuary state? And also who knows who else will turn against?
And I'm in the process of, I've been reaching out right back to the helpers. I'm reaching out, trying to ask for insights of those who maybe are more savvy than I in this space. I don't really follow politics that much. So how would I know? And one key insight we've received so far is it can also change pretty quickly. You know, I had in my mind that it's likely, you know, 4 to 6 years, things change. And just like we've talked about in our state, the question, we're grateful for our governor having vetoed some of these things. And in 2 years for midterm elections, when midterm elections come up, if there is a conservative supermajority, then it renders our governor moot. You know, like he becomes a lame duck potentially, right?
Right. They don't have a supermajority right now. So that's what also helps his vetoes.
Exactly. And so if that were to happen, right, then, okay, well, then is it another 2 years before a change can happen again? And how frequently can some of these things be overturned? It's terrifying. And we just can't know.
So for all of us, it's a continuous, like you said, risk-benefit analysis and just trying to make the best decisions with the information we have right now. And knowing that each of us are in different boats. I mean, even you and I, who are not far from each other, we're still in different boats. And so the best decision for one may not be the best decision for the other. We just have to keep, I hope as a community, that we keep supporting each other through that, understanding that, like, if you've got to move, you know, I'm cheering you on and helping you. And if you decide to stay, I'm cheering you on and helping you, and vice versa.
So for our listeners, if you're on this boat with us, hope you have helpers you can lean into. And if you're observing the boat, please share your support, right? Go to these school board meetings, make sure you're voting, dedicate dollars if this is important to you, right? To the organizations that are supporting all the really hard work that's happening out there in the legal space. And I think, as Diana, as you mentioned, if you have medical care being offered nearby, share your gratitude that that's happening, whether or not you're taking advantage of that care. Whether it's relevant for you or not, it's relevant for the community around you.
I think the hospitals just need to be reminded that it can be an attractive option to some, even if it's not used, that they provide that care. Thank you.
That's a wrap on this episode of Transparently Speaking. Thanks for joining us today. Join us again on the 1st and 15th of every month for our next podcast.
Thank you to Filter for our awesome music. That's P-H-I-L-T-Y-R. Check them out at Apple Music, YouTube Music, Spotify, or anywhere you download music. As a reminder, we welcome your feedback and questions. Email us anytime at transparentlyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com.
If you're taking something away from our podcast, we'd appreciate if you'd take a moment to provide us a review. The more listeners and reviews, the more people we can reach and support. Thanks in advance. Cheers from Joy
and Diana.